Chapter 5. Explanation, not perhaps of her presence at Ritz's, but of her means of subsistence there. What really perplexed him was not the financial, but the social aspect of the case. When Mrs. Newell had left London in July, as he had told him that, between Cowes and Scotland, she and Hermy were provided for till the middle of October. After that, as she put it, they would have to look about. Why, then, when as he had in her hand the opportunity of living for 3 months at the expense of the British aristocracy, did she rush off to Paris at heaven, knew whose expense in the beginning of September? She was not a woman to act incoherently. If she made mistakes, they were not of that kind. Garnet felt sure she would never willingly relax her hold on her distinguished friends. Was it possible that it was they who had somewhat violently let go of her? As Garnet reviewed the situation, he began to see that this possibility had for some time been latent in it. He had felt that something might happen at any moment, and was not this the something he had obscurely foreseen? Mrs. Newell really moved too fast. Her position was as perilous as that of an invading army without a base of supplies. She used up everything too quickly: friends, credit, influence, forbearance. It was so easy for her to acquire all these, what a pity as he had never learned to keep them. He himself, for instance, the most insignificant of her acquisitions, was beginning to feel like a squeezed sponge at the mere thought of her, and it was this sense of exhaustion, of the inability to provide more, either materially or morally, which had provoked his exclamation on opening her note. From the first days of their acquaintance, her prodigality had amazed him, but he had believed it to be surpassed by the infinity of her resources. If she exhausted old supplies, she always found new ones to replace them. When one set of people began to find her impossible, another was always beginning to find her indispensable. Yes, but there were limits. There were only so many sets of people, at least in her social classification, and when she came to an end of them, what then? Was this flight to Paris a sign that as he had come to an end? Was she going to try Paris because London had failed her? The time of year precluded such a conjecture. Mrs. Newell's Paris was non-existent in September. The town was a desert of gaping trippers. He could as soon think of her seeking social restoration at Margate. For a moment it occurred to him that she might have to come over to replenish her wardrobe, but he knew her dates too well to dwell long on this hope. It was in April and December that she visited the dressmakers. Before December, he had heard her explain, one got nothing but the American fashions. Mrs. Newell's scorn of all things American was somewhat logically coupled with the determination to use her own Americanism to the utmost as a means of social advance. As he had found out long ago that, on certain lines, it paid in London to be American, and as he had manufactured for herself a personality independent of geographical or social demarcations, and presenting that remarkable blend of plantation dialect, Bowery slang and hyperbolic statement, which is the British nobility's favorite idea of an unadulterated Americanism. Mrs. Newell, for all her talents, was not naturally either humorous or hyperbolic, and there were times when it would doubtless have been a relief to her to be as monumentally stolid as some of the persons whose dullness it was her fate to enliven. It was perhaps the need of relaxing which had drawn her into her odd intimacy with Garnet, with whom she did not have to be either scrupulously English or artificially American, since the impression she made on him was of no more consequence than that which she produced on her footman. Garnet was perfectly aware that he owed his success to his insignificance, but the fact affected him only as adding one more element to his knowledge of Mrs. Newell's character. He was as ready to sacrifice his personal vanity in such a cause as he had been, at the outset of their acquaintance, to sacrifice his professional pride to the opportunity of knowing her. When he had accepted the position of London correspondent with an occasional side glance at Paris, to the New York Searchlight, he had not understood that his work was to include the obligation of interviewing. Indeed, had the possibility presented itself in advance, he would have met it by unpacking his valise and returning to the drudgery of his assistant editorship in New York. But when, after 3 months in Europe, he received a letter from his chief, suggesting that he should enliven the Sunday Searchlight by a series of talks with smart Americans in London, beginning, say, with Mrs. Sam Newell, the change of focus already enabled him to view the proposal without passion. For his life on the edge of the great world cauldron of art, politics and pleasure of that high spice brew which is nowhere else so subtly and variously compounded had bred in him an eager appetite to taste of the heady mixture. He knew he should never have the full spoon at his lips, but he recalled the peasant girl in one of Browning's plays, who has once eaten polenta cut with a knife which has carved an ortolan. Might not Mrs. Newell, who had so successfully cut a way into the dense and succulent mass of English society, serve as the knife to season his polenta? He had expected, as the result of the interview, to which she promptly, almost eagerly, assented, no more than the glimpse of brightly lit vistas which a waiting messenger may catch through open doors. But instead he had found himself drawn at once into the inner sanctuary, not of London society, but of Mrs. Newell's relation to it. As he had been candidly charmed by the idea of the interview, it struck him that she was conscious of the need of being freshened up. Her appearance was brilliantly fresh, with the inveterate freshness of the toilet table. Her paint was as impenetrable as armor. But her personality was a little tarnished. She was in want of social renovation. As he had been doing and saying the same things for too long a time. London, cows, Hamburg, Scotland, Monte Carlo, that had been around since Hermie was a baby. Hermie was her daughter, Miss Hermione Newell, who was called in presently to be shown off to the interviewer and add a paragraph to the celebration of her mother's charms. Miss Newell's appearance was so full of an unassisted freshness that for a moment Garnet made the mistake of fancying that she could fill a paragraph of her own. But he soon found that her vague personality was merely tributary to her parents, that her youth and grace were, in some mysterious way, her mother's rather than her own. She smiled obediently on Garnet, but could contribute little beyond her smile, and the general sweetness of her presence, to the picture of Mrs. Newell's existence which it was the young man's business to draw. And presently he found that as he had left the room without his noticing it, he learned in time that this unnoticeableness was the most conspicuous thing about her. Burning at best with a mild light, she became invisible in the glare of her mother's personality. It was in fact only as a product of her environment that poor Hermione struck the imagination. With the smartest woman in London as her guide and example, as he had never developed a taste for dress, and with opportunities for enlightenment from which Garnet's fancy recoiled, she remained simple, unsuspicious and tender, with an inclination to good works and afternoon church, a taste for the society of dull girls, and a clinging fidelity to old governesses and retired nursemaids. Mrs. Newell, whose boast it was that she looked facts in the face, frankly owned that as he had not been able to make anything of Hermione. "If as he has a role I haven't discovered it," she confessed to Garnet. "I've tried everything, but she doesn't fit in anywhere." Mrs. Newell spoke as if her daughter were a piece of furniture acquired without due reflection, and for which no suitable place could be found. She got, of course, what she could out of Hermione, who wrote her notes, ran her errands, saw tiresome people for her, and occupied an intermediate office between that of lady's maid and secretary. But such small returns on her investment were not what Mrs. Newell had counted on. What was the use of producing and educating a handsome daughter if she did not, in some more positive way, contribute to her parents' advancement? 3. "It's about Hermie," Mrs. Newell said, rising from the heap of embroidered cushions which formed the background of her afternoon repose. Her sitting room at Ritz's was full of penetrating warmth and fragrance. Long-stemmed roses filled the vases on the chimneypiece, in which a fire sparkled with that effect of luxury which fires produce when the weather is not cold enough to justify them. On the writing table, among notes and cards, and signed photographs of celebrities, Mrs. Newell's gold inkstand, her jeweled penholder, her heavily monogrammed dispatch box, gave back from their expensive surfaces the glint of the flame, which sought out and magnified the orient of the pearls among the lady's laces, and found a mirror in the pinky polish of her fingertips. It was just such a scene as a little September fire, lit for show, and not for warmth, would delight to dwell on and pick out in all its opulent details. And even Garnet, inured to Mrs. Newell's capacity for extracting manna from the desert, reflected that she must have found new fields to glean. "It's about Hermy," she repeated, making room for him among the cushions. I had to see you at once. We came over yesterday from London." Garnet, seating himself, continued his leisurely survey of the room. In the glitter of Mrs. Newell's magnificence, Hermione, as usual, faded out of sight, and he hardly noticed her mother's illusion. "I have never seen you more resplendent," he remarked. She received the tribute with complacency. "Tea, the rooms are not bad, are they? We came over with the Woolsey Hubbards. You've heard of them, of course. They're from Detroit, and really they do things very decently. Their motor car met us at Bowlin, and the courier always wires ahead to have the rooms filled with flowers. This salon is really a part of their suite. I simply couldn't have afforded it myself." She delivered these facts in a high, decisive voice, which had a note akin to the clink of her many bracelets, and the rattle of her ringed hands against the enameled cigarette case which she extended to Garnet, after helping herself from its contents. "You are always meeting such charming people," said Garnet with mild irony, and, reverting to her first remark, he bethought himself to add, "I hope Miss Hermione is not ill?" "Ill? She was never ill in her life," exclaimed Mrs. Newell, as though her daughter had been accused of an indelicacy. "It was only that you said you had come over on her account." "So I have. Hermione is to be married." Mrs. Newell brought out the words impressively, drawing back to observe their effect on her visitor. It was such that he received them with a long silent stare, which finally passed into a cry of wonder. "Am married? For heaven's sake, to whom?" Mrs. Newell continued to regard him with a smile so serene and victorious that he saw she took his somewhat unseemly astonishment as a merited tribute to her genius. Presently she extended a glittering hand, and took a sheet of notepaper from the blotter. "You can have that put in tomorrow's Herald," she said. Garnet, receiving the paper, read in Hermione's own finished hand, "A marriage has been arranged, and will shortly take place, between the Comte Louis Dutrayes, son of the Marquis Dutrayes de La Baume, and Miss Hermione Newell, daughter of Samuel C. Newell Esker. Of Elmira, N.Y. Comte Louis Dutrayes belongs to one of the oldest and most distinguished families in France, and is equally well connected in England, being the nephew of Lord St. Briscoe, and a cousin of the Countess of Morningfield, whom he frequently visits at Adam and Portlow." The perusal of this document filled Garnet with such deepening wonder that he could not, for the moment, even do justice to the strangeness of its being written out for publication in the bride's own hand. Hermione a bride. Hermione a future countess. Hermione on the brink of a marriage which would give her not only a great situation in the Parisian world, but a footing in some of the best houses in England. Regardless of its unflattering implications, Garnet prolonged his stare of mute amazement till Mrs. Newell somewhat sharply exclaimed, "Didn't I always tell you that she would marry a Frenchman?" Garnet, in spite of himself, smiled at this revised version of his hostess's frequent assertion that Hermione was too goody-goody to take in England, but that with her little doughty air she might very well go off in the faubourg, if only a dot could be raked up for her, and the recollection flashed a new light on the versatility of Mrs. Newell's genius. But how did you do it was on the tip of his tongue, and he had barely time to give the query the more conventional turn of colon how did it happen? Oh, we were up at Glace with the Edmund Fitzarthurs. Lady Edmund is a sort of cousin of the Morningfields, who have a shooting lodge near Glace, a place called Portlow, and young Tryas was there with them. Lady Edmund, who is a dear, drove Hermy over to Portlow, and the thing was done in no time. He simply fell over head and ears in love with her. You know Hermy is really very handsome in her peculiar way. I don't think you have ever appreciated her, Mrs. Newell summed up with a note of exquisite reproach. I've appreciated her, I assure you, but one somehow didn't think of her marrying so soon. Soon? She's 23, but you've no imagination, said Mrs. Newell, and Garnet inwardly admitted that he had not enough to soar to the heights of her invention. For the marriage, of course, was an invention of her own, a superlative stroke of business, in which he was sure the principal parties had all been passive agents, in which everyone, from the bankrupt and disreputable Fitzarthurs to the rich and immaculate Morningfields, had by some mysterious sleight of hand been made to fit into Mrs. Newell's designs. But it was not enough for Garnet to marvel at her work, he wanted to understand it, to take it apart, to find out how the trick had been done. It was true that Mrs. Newell had always said Hermy might go off in the faubourg, if he had a dot, but even Mrs. Newell's juggling could hardly conjure up a dot. Such feats as she was able to perform in this line were usually made to serve her own urgent necessities. And besides, who was likely to take sufficient interest in Hermione to supply her with the means of marrying a French nobleman? The flowers ordered in advance by the Woolsey Hubbard's courier made Garnet wonder if that accomplished functionary had also wired over to have Miss Newell's settlements drawn up. But of all the comments hovering on his lips, the only one he could decently formulate was the remark that he supposed Mrs. Newell and her daughter had come over to see the young man's family and make the final arrangements. Oh, they're made, everything is settled, said Mrs. Newell, looking him squarely in the eye. Why, you're wondering, of course, about the dot. Frenchmen never go off their heads to the extent of forgetting that, or at least their parents don't allow them to. Garnet murmured a vague assent, and she went on without the least appearance of resenting his curiosity, colon it all came about so fortunately. Only fancy, just the week they met I got a little legacy from an aunt in Elmira, a good soul I hadn't seen or heard of for years. I suppose I ought to have put on mourning for her, by the way, but it would have eaten up a good bit of the legacy, and I really needed it all for poor Hermy. Oh, it's not a fortune, you understand, but the young man is madly in love, and has always had. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.